Are there any passages of the Bible that make you want to scream at the protagonist? How could you be so stupid? Didn't you listen to what God said? Then, of course, we have to realise that's precisely the way that we frequently behave, committing sins that are not just sins, but are foolish sins. This is episode 47 of the Proverbs 18:10 podcast.
And if you're saying that you know truth, if you're saying that you know what is truth, then you've got to have something to actually measure that against.
Proverbs 18:10 podcast.
25 feet, 1,000 layers. How many millions of years did that take to form then? The answer is it took 3 hours.
Proverbs 18:10 podcast.
This is the Proverbs 18:10 podcast, presented by me, Paul Taylor, in association with Proverbs 18:10 Media. For all information about the podcast, including where to find the RSS feeds to put into your favorite podcasting software, please visit proverbs1810.org. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Proverbs 18:10 podcast. My name is Paul Taylor. I'm very glad that you've joined us for this podcast. This is my main apologetics podcast, and at the moment I'm going through stuff to do with Genesis. I'm trying to get through a lot of material on Genesis. It's a wonderful book. It's 50 chapters altogether. It's going to be more than 50 broadcasts, and I really want to make sure that there is this body of material available on the web. Because this has been my life's work. I'm well into material which is now part of my second volume of the commentary about Genesis, Volume 2. And you can get that book from my bookstore website, which is allaboutbooks.store. Allaboutbooks.store. Please go and have a look at that website. You can purchase the book from there. You can get the book on Amazon too, but you can get the book in paperback and in ebook form on allaboutbooks.store. It's an ebook version that is released under Creative Commons license, and you can pay what you think you can afford to pay for that if you get the ebook version. The paperback, obviously, there are production costs, which is at the moment being produced by Amazon, so you would have to pay more for that. But I want to get these books into the hands of people as much as possible. It'll take a little while before I'm able to get actually volume one available in that format, that special ebook format, but we're getting there. So this podcast is brought to you and sponsored by allaboutbooks.store, the repository for good Christian and conservative books. Please have a look at that site, allaboutbooks.store. Investigate also the other podcasts at proverbs1810.org. That's Proverbs 1810 Media. The website is proverbs1810.org. Well, this week in episode 47, we're now looking at Genesis chapter 16, and we're looking at the Abrahamic covenant again, but it's how the Abrahamic covenant was misunderstood. Genesis 16, in fact, starts by reminding us about Sarai's condition. She hadn't borne any children to Abraham. That's because she was barren. Remember, it's not because of her age at this stage, although she is beginning to get on in years, she's barren. It's 10 years after Abraham and Sarai have come to Canaan, and so Abraham is 85 and Sarai 75 years old. If you look at the calculation that we made in Genesis chapter 12, we can see that Sarai was the equivalent of a modern 35-year-old, so she's still just about within childbearing age, but she's barren. And there's a progression of misunderstanding for Abraham and Sarai. In Genesis 12, Abraham was told that all nations would be blessed through him. So by Genesis 15, he decided that his heir must be a member of his household. No, God told him, his heir's going to be his physical son. So in Genesis 16, Sarai has accepted that Abraham will have a physical son, but she's decided that the son might not come directly from her. And you might wonder why it is then that she offers her servant, her Egyptian servant Hagar, to her husband. We need to understand this because there's quite a lot in Genesis that depends on what follows next. It could be said that what follows next, as Sarai gives her Egyptian servant Hagar to her husband, it could be said that she had a legal case for her action. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, in his commentary on Genesis, has suggested that the Babylonian Code of Hammurabi was in practice at this time. Now, the Code of Hammurabi allows for a wife's slave to be used as a concubine and for the child of such a union to be counted as that of the legal wife. And Fruchtenbaum's commentary makes the point that I'll make in a moment, that the law of the area at that time may have allowed for a practice. But remember, just because there's a law that allows for something, and that might be the culture, it could still be a sin against God. It could be that the law of the land, and this is frequently the case in today's society, that the law of the land could be against the law of God. So it's no good appealing to the law of the land and say, well, look, it's legally okay to do this. It might be legally okay for the law of the land. For example, today it's legally okay for two men to get married. And this is something we will investigate in Genesis further in a few more chapters. So the law of the land suggests that it is okay for two men to get married. God's law says it is not. God's law has not changed. So it's illegal in God's eyes. What's legal in the society can be illegal in God's eyes, and vice versa. Something that is perfectly legal, God permits and in fact may command, could be, according to the law of the land, illegal. We can find numerous examples of both of those, and for talking about how these things connect with today's society, you'll probably have to catch one of my other podcasts on Fridays, my podcast In the Car with Paul Taylor, where I try and go through some of the political implications of the things that we teach in apologetics. So let's stick now, rather than going into contemporary work, let's stick with what is happening in the time of Genesis chapter 16. Okay, so the legal position of Hagar is still very important, and it was used by God in his mercy and his providence. Now, Hagar is actually a Hebrew name, and she's described here in Genesis chapter 16, verse 3, as Hagar the Egyptian. Her Hebrew name means flight, and that suggests that she was part of the plunder that was given to Abraham during his really disastrous sojourn in Egypt. Now, whatever we might think of the rightness of her legal position today, it's clear that she was in service to Abraham and Sarai. Now, Arabic people are descendants of Hagar's son Ishmael, and Muhammad claimed to be of Ishmaelite descent. Therefore, Muslims, and indeed atheists, make a great deal of the alleged status of Ishmael and Hagar. Critics of a biblical position assume that because Hagar was legally a wife, that means that Abraham had two legal wives, just as Jacob would do later. That would mean that even though Sarai was his first wife, Ishmael would be Abraham's firstborn. And that casts the later expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael in Genesis chapter 21 as a legal problem. And it also forms part of the It also forms part of the Islamic claim that they are the true descendants of Abraham. Genesis 16 verse 3 seems at first glance to suggest that Hagar became Abraham's wife, but when we stop and think, we realize that she was given to Abraham by Sarai, his real wife, to use as a wife. And there's importance in that phrase. In verse 4, we read that Abraham went into her. There is no evidence from anything later, by the way, that Abraham ever committed that act with Hagar again. That's notwithstanding the fact that there are some people who believe that Keturah, who is mentioned later in Genesis, is the same person as Hagar, which I don't think is correct. The end of verse 4, we read that Hagar looked with contempt on her mistress. Now, let's emphasize the word mistress here. That shows, the fact that that word is used, shows that Hagar was still under Sarai's authority. She's been used as a wife, Therefore, she's legally Abraham's concubine because she's under Sarai's authority. Okay, God emphasizes that shortly as well in what goes on next. We must continue to emphasize that the legal status in no way excuses the sin that has taken place, and it is a sin. But we need to discuss that the legal status shows that Ishmael's position as firstborn was not as firstborn of Sarai. That honor would still legally be Isaac's. In any event, God could and would rearrange the priority of the firstborn on many other occasions, even between brothers born of a legal and biblically correct wife. For example, look at the relationship between Manasseh and Ephraim, the sons of Joseph. Jacob counted those as his own sons. And what we find is that Jacob swapped his hands over when he blessed the sons of Joseph, so that he made the one who was born second as the firstborn, and the one who was born first as the secondborn. And that's a very, very important point. It's not the only occasion where something like that happens either. When we discuss the Lord meeting with Hagar later in a short while, we'll see that the Lord was commanding her to return to her mistress and submit to her. So God says, return to your mistress and submit to her. That reveals that God considered her still to be subject to Sarai, and therefore Hagar is not equivalent to a wife. Gives her the status of concubine, and that point is emphasized later in Genesis as we get to the end of Abraham's life. Now, none of this changes what God's will for marriage is. You've got to understand that none of this changes the fact that God had stated in the beginning that God's will for marriage was one man and one woman. The point is that the Bible tells the truth as it is, and it tells us about our heroes, like Abraham, warts and all. We frequently find that. So where people who are God's people are doing something that is wrong in God's sight, it is still reported. The biblical history is not twisted in order to give a favourable opinion on the conquerors, on the person who's up front. I mean, there's no more important king in the time of Israel later, is there, than King David? So we read about David's sin, the things he did wrong. We read about those. It doesn't change the fact that God describes David as a man after his own heart. And Abraham's sins here do not change the fact that he's described as the friend of God. So incidentally, we can apply that to ourselves. And my sins do not change the fact that God also counts me as his friend, because that's what Jesus talked about in the New Testament. Because my salvation depends on Jesus and depends on faith, not on my perfection. Obviously, my sanctification depends on my obedience. Day to day, whether I'm close to God or not, depends on my obedience. But my salvation does not depend on my obedience. Praise God for that. Now, the first recorded polygamist in the Bible was Cain's descendant, Lamech. That's not the same Lamech, of course, as who was the father of Noah. So a descendant of Cain called Lamech. And this account in Genesis 16 appears to be the first account of God overlooking polygamy among his own people. There are a number of examples of polygamous relationships from this point on who were God's servants. Jacob is going to be pointed out as one. David and Solomon, those are three that spring to mind. And by the way, the fact that there is no report of any polygamy of Isaac, I think, is very significant indeed. Also, the fact there's no report of polygamy of Joseph in this from Genesis 12 onwards, the fact that our four main characters, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, two of those are monogamous. And in Abraham's case, we're seeing that despite the fact that he's sinned, he seems to be behaving as monogamous. And the exception there is Jacob. And there's reasons when we get to talk about Jacob why God allows that. But it doesn't mean that God approves of it. There's no suggestion that God approves of polygamy. His ideal remains what he instituted in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. This is what Henry Morris says, for instance. There are many instances recorded of polygamous marriages in the Bible, which God allowed because of mitigating circumstances at the time. But there's no report of a happy polygamous marriage. We'll see that when we get to talk about Jacob, how the there are problems there. It's worth noting then in verse 2 that Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. That's the sort of language that ought to be used of how we listen to God. In fact, in Genesis chapter 22, we read that Abraham listened to God's voice rather than Sarai's. But at this point, we're reading that Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. Both Abraham and Sarai are to blame, therefore, for the mess that they're about to make. We can't excuse Abraham from this, just because this starts off as Sarai's idea. So at this point, Hagar is perhaps less to blame, in fact, of the three characters. And she probably doesn't have the power to refuse anyway. But there's no record that she objected to the relationship, so she does bear a measure of responsibility, albeit it's less than that of Abraham and Sarai. Perhaps we ought to ask where Hagar had come from. Remember, she was from Egypt. If Abraham hadn't made that disastrous trip to Egypt, perhaps Sarai wouldn't have had a maidservant at hand to lend to Abraham. But that's speculation. It's certainly true, however, that any offspring of a union between Abraham and Hagar would be Sarai's property. And none of this goes well. There's no doubt it was a sinful situation. Jesus himself, when he asked about marriage, pointed people to the first two chapters of Genesis to emphasize that marriage was to be between only two people, one man and one woman. Sarai was still Abraham's wife, but Abraham goes into Hagar as a wife. Abraham was using her as a wife, but she wasn't on the same level of importance as Sarai. Hagar's therefore a concubine. Hagar becomes contemptuous of Sarai, we read. Sarah, in her turn, mistreated Hagar, also a sin on Sarai's part, and she puts the blame on Abraham. With all her mistreatment, then, Hagar flees the situation. And God is merciful, even to people who are almost incidental to the account at hand. God was certainly merciful to Hagar. It tells us that the angel of the Lord appeared. Now, this is the first appearance of that phrase in the Bible. We read over and over again about the angel of the Lord. Let's just first of all mention who the angel of the Lord would seem to be. But then we'll look at the significance of the fact that the first appearance of the angel of the Lord was to Hagar. Well, the angel of the Lord isn't just any angel. For example, in verse 13, we understand that the particular appearance was actually an appearance of God himself. So the angel of the Lord is not a creature angel. He's what we refer to theologically as a theophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of the second person of the Trinity in human form. That's a long, theological, complex way of saying this was Jesus. This was Jesus who showed up and appeared to Hagar. I guess, therefore, that that's the moment that Hagar came into true faith. And it's an act of mercy on God's part that the first time he appears as the angel of the Lord, he does so to a foreigner. He does so to a foreigner, an Egyptian, emphasizing that God has always been the God of the whole world. Anyone who is entitled to come to the Lord and have fellowship with him, even though he's about to demonstrate his will through his concentration on the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, nevertheless, God gives Hagar a promise concerning her unborn son that a great nation would also come from him. God sends her back. The angel asked Hagar a question. And we've already discussed before that questions are not asked for God's benefit. God knows the answer. When he asks a question, it's not so that he can gain information that he didn't know. He knows everything already. The question is for the benefit of the person who's being questioned. So God says to Hagar, he asks her, Hagar, servant of Sarai, so he's emphasizing who she is, what her position is, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? Where are you going? He knows where she's come from, and he knows where she's going. And she doesn't know. She thinks she is going away, but God knows that she's going back. So you see, the question was not for God's benefit. He knows the answer. The question is for Hagar's benefit, so that he now can tell her, no, you're going back to your mistress and you're going to submit to her. And then he pours out his blessing. He says, I'll surely multiply your offspring so they can't be numbered for multitude. Behold, you're pregnant. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. That is what the word Ishmael means. He goes on and says, well, he's going to be a wild donkey of a man. His hand is against everyone, everyone's hand against him. He shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. So there's such a blessing there. And Hagar responds with faith. Okay, this first appearance of the angel of the Lord, the first time that the phrase angel of the Lord is named. I think there have been occasions previously when the pre-incarnate Jesus has appeared to people, but this is the first time that he is described as the angel of the Lord. And so she responds, she says, you're a God of seeing. Truly I've seen him who looks after me. You're a God of seeing. Truly, here I've seen him who looks after me. That's a testimony of faith. And that's why the well is called Beer Lahay Roy, because that's what that means. It's the well of the God who sees. And so there's blessing there and there's faith there. And in the midst of sin and complication, there's going to be such problems for this encampment. There's going to be such problems by the fact that you've got a servant girl who's pregnant, a servant girl who gives birth, and then there's going to be problems with this boy growing up. Abraham and Sarai really made a mess of things with what they've done. But God's also going to bring blessing, because that's the way that God is. There's that response to the word of faith. And so there's always blessings, even in the midst of error. You may have experienced that yourself. I certainly have, that in the midst of errors, in the midst of mistakes, in the midst even of sins, God can choose to bless, because that's his sovereign will. We don't know why he does, but he chooses to bless. And praise God that that is the case. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast. If you enjoy these podcasts, don't forget there's a number of other podcasts that you can listen to. You can find them all at proverbs1810.org. That's the website for Proverbs 1810 Media. Go and have a look at that, please. And also, please support me by going to subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor. These podcasts are issued free, but they're not free to produce, because, you know, there's certain costs. There's certainly costs in time. And don't forget, I'm also having published volume 2 of About Genesis, and now getting started on volume 3. So if you want to help me with that time support me with producing those books and producing these podcasts, please head over to subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor and consider sponsoring me to a sum of at least $5 a month on that website. But meanwhile, thank you for listening. Don't forget to keep your podcast software up to date. This episode is dropping a day late, but it's only one day late. It should have dropped on Tuesday, the 25th of January. The next one should drop on, 25 plus 7. Yeah, that should be February the 1st, Tuesday, February the 1st. So please look out for that. And in the meantime, God bless you. Thank you for being here. So many people seem to give the impression that the Bible starts being true at Genesis chapter 12, where we start with the life of Abraham, the great example of faith to us all. Now, my name's Paul Taylor. I'm the author of the About Genesis project, and it's been my life's work to try and show people how the book of Genesis is true from the very beginning. So volume 1 of About Genesis, which was published 2 years ago, takes us through the first 9 chapters of Genesis and takes a lot of time showing how this is historically true and is foundational for everything else. Now we pick up with volume 2 from chapter 10 through chapter 25.
The central part of this is, of course, chapter 12, where we're getting into the life of Abraham himself. God says to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So we're still talking about the beginnings of all things and how God is blessing the whole earth through Abraham. Well, there are so many things to find out about Abraham. When we read that Abraham was 75 years old when he first came to the land of Canaan, we picture him as an old man, and his wife Sarah being just 10 years younger as an old lady. In fact, we find out that both of them lived for a very long time, and that makes sense because it was within the decay of the ages of the patriarchs that we only understand if we believe the first 11 chapters of Genesis to be true. So therefore we find out that actually Abraham and Sarah were young people at the ages of 75 and 65. It's a bit mind-boggling, but it's the case, and therefore we need to understand what happened in their lives over the next decades in that slower process of aging that would have been happening there. There's so much in the life of Abraham and Sarah that we need to understand, and it speaks about the gospel. It speaks about the future incarnation of Jesus Christ. It speaks about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It speaks about eschatology of the second coming of Jesus Christ. All these things God poured into and through the life of this fallible man, Abraham, who made mistakes, and we learn from his mistakes. But nevertheless, he's described as the friend of God. This is such an important aspect of Scripture, and I want people to be able to get hold of it. So it's been published through Amazon. You can get the paperback, and you can get the Kindle version through all the various types of Amazon, .com, .co.uk, the EU version, Canadian, Australian, Brazilian, and so on. But you can also get the book at allaboutbooks.store, including an open source ebook version there with instructions about how to download it, how to be able to get it at a price that you can afford, that you can choose, and how to be able to look at that. Volume 2 of About Genesis is available now. I hope you'll avail yourselves of it. I hope it's an encouragement to you. Thank you for listening. May God bless you.